I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone, welcome to our very first episode of From Bench to Podcast, Stories from Biotech Labs, a new podcast series from Nature Biotechnology. My name is Claudia Villene. I'm associate editor at the journal and today's podcast host. On this new series, we aim to interview authors, or more specifically, early career researchers behind very cool papers that get published in our journal. So in this short chat, we want to explore a little bit the behind the scenes of papers from another perspective, so really from bench to podcast. And today I have the enormous pleasure to be talking with Marcus Walker, a first author of, I must say, one of my favorite papers of the year so far. So hi, Marcus, welcome to our podcast. And first of all, thank you for accepting the invitation and for being our first invited speaker. Let me just introduce you briefly before we kick in. So Marcus did his PhD at the lab of Tom Ellis at Imperial College London, where he worked in synthetic biology, or particularly on the biofabrication of cellulose materials. As for now, Marcus actually is a synthetic biologist at Oxman, a company that creates design solutions combining technology, biology, and with a big focus on nature and sustainability. But from his work and the topic of where we are going to talk about today, from his PhD work, a really cool paper came out called Self-Pigmenting Textiles Grown from Cellulose-Producing Bacteria with Engineered Tyrosinase Expression. So it's a long title, but I guarantee you this is a very straightforward and cool story. So, Marcus, why don't you go ahead and give us a sum up of this story?
Sure. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast. Yes, so the paper, I guess, it's, to a certain extent, it's an attempt to try to understand how synthetic biology can do something for the fashion industry or for biodesign. So quite simply, the paper is, I take an organism that makes cellulose, bacterial cellulose, and artists and designers have already been working with this material that is made by these bacteria to make dresses, wallets. It's gone up through a few sort of art exhibitions. People have tried to make proper clothing with this before, and I was coming from a very different perspective, trying to see, like, well, if I can apply synthetic biology, what can I do to actually transform that side of the process? And so essentially the paper is about trying to introduce pigmentation into this material through synthetic biology. So in the paper, I engineer in an enzyme tyrosinase, and this is an enzyme that produces melanin. It's a single enzyme that converts tyrosine into L-DOPA, and that actually spontaneously converts into eumelanin. And melanin is something, you know, a pigment that we're all pretty familiar with. It's like the pigment in our hair and in our skin. And it, yes, it turns the material black, basically. And so that's, like, you know, a big portion of the paper. It's just about, like, how do I grow these materials, and what do they look like, and what are, like, the mechanical properties of these materials once they've produced melanin. Melanin itself is, like, a very interesting compound from a lot of perspectives. Like, it's electrically conductive, UV protectant. It's, you know, a lot of things that mushrooms produce it. It's you know, a very ubiquitous molecule. But the sort of the end of the paper is where I was trying to sort of push it more into the future, which is where I'm trying to understand how do I pattern the production of this pigment inside the material. And like, again, like the way biology tends to pattern stuff is through sort of diffusion and all these interesting reaction diffusion sort of processes to get like spots and marks across the skin. But from the perspective of me as a scientist, that's very tricky to do through synthetic biology. And so I went for like an optogenetics approach, which is I was trying to use light to predict or project where I'd want these patterns to show up in the actual material. And the again, like in a way, like that formed, yes, like the last figure, but that probably also took the most time to figure out because, the optogenetic system was very tricky to work with. This was all happening in a non-model organism, Comagatia bacteraticus. So having to sort of reintroduce synthetic biology tools into this for the first time or introduce synthetic biology tools into this for the first time. And yeah, that took a few years. I got the optogenetics to work very well producing fluorescent proteins. And then trying to pigment the actual melanin itself was pretty tricky. And I think in the end, in the paper, you'll see this, I have these markings on the actual bacterial cells itself, but it still could go a lot further, I think. Maybe that's a little bit longer than a brief summary. But.
No, that was great. I think there was a great description, and you mentioned already some very cool things that I also wanted to point out. So as a reader, I really say, and it was an awesome read, because it's so fascinating, as you said. So it's kind of a simple approach. You take something that already exists, that we have. You engineer a pathogen that is quite easy also to work with, so bacteria in general, and you make it produce something that is basically looking at nature and asking, okay, what are you, nature, already doing, and how can we just kind of go a bit around and use it for something that, as you said, is a very interesting field, which is biodesign, right? So you mentioned the pigmentation. So you and in this paper, when you guys at home can take a look at this paper, you're going to see that it's black. So the color of choice is black, which is actually in industry, in fashion industry, one of the most expensive, so most famous or more usable one, and most expensive ones to produce, right? Exactly. So, and then, as you mentioned also in the last part of the paper, we have the pattern, the patterning, which for me was also great because it gives that extra step and can open now that door for this not going to be just one color, can be also with patterns and is light inducible. And something very cool that now you just said is that it's a last figure, but it actually took the longest. For curiosity, so the engineering part, right? So just the pure, let's say, basic, or not basic, the pure synthetic biology part. This was not the one that was more time-consuming, or?
So definitely, like, for the bulk of the, sort of the first three figures of the paper, it's all based around sort of one gene being put into bacteriocytes. And so I have one on the plasmid, one on the chromosome, but clearly with a synthetic biology toolkit, this is not a months-long process. Yes, I maybe iterated a little bit, but that was quite simple. And the rest of that time was really just like testing it and seeing the materials and figuring out the process itself. Exactly. How do I actually, yes, I have the gene, yes, it's being expressed, but like getting it to produce the black material, I mean, I didn't know it was going to work as well, and so I figured out a process to make it work well. But in terms of the core, like the synthetic biology at the end, yeah, that was a lot of time. I think with the optogenetics, we had very limited tools at the beginning of synthetic biology tools for this bacteria. So quite literally, we had sort of one origin of replication that we were confident was working in this bacteria well. We had one antibiotic that we were comfortable using with this bacteria. Most optogenetic systems are sort of split across multiple plasmids, in which case you need multiple origins, or they have membrane-bound or membrane-associated parts. And again, like when you're working with a non-model organism, you kind of want to avoid as many like failure points as possible. Like if it's going into the membrane, is it going to work the same way? Are things going to fall apart? So it took a while first for me to settle on which system I was going to try and use in the bacteria, and I ended up using the T7 opto system from Mustafa Kamash's lab at ETH. And that system I liked, one, because it was very orthogonal. So it's using an RNA polymerase to do the expression. It's not based on sort of trying to figure out the native sigma factors and everything that are based in the original inside K. reticus. And in terms of the engineering, again, it was just a lot of moving all the parts onto one plasmid, essentially. So the first time I put all the parts onto one plasmid with the origin replication and the antibody that we know worked, and then that was sort of my proof of concept. And so with this, I was able to pattern mCHARI production inside a bacterial cellulose pellicle. So once I knew that it worked, I went and then went on to the next step, which was actually trying to optimize or find the best way to have the biggest like fold change, dark to light. And my thinking was that if I can get the biggest one, then I'll get the most defined patterning when I go to switch from using fluorescent proteins to using the taurosinase. And to do that, essentially, firstly, we had to come up with a good process for doing genome integration into this bacteria. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I wanted to have was to have the parts, the actual genetic components, be on the chromosome.
Okay.
And then being able to switch out quite easily the actual target gene that is being produced, say 1.8M scarlet, it could be mCHARI, maybe it could be taurosinase, maybe it could be a different pigment. And then I also just needed to try an array of these different systems inside K. reticus. So again, figuring out protocol, that was actually part of a earlier paper that I put it with Vivian Goossens, Viv Goossens, and that's the paper that came out in ACS Symbio about a synthetic biology toolkit for K. reticus. So once we had that, then I was able to make a series of constructs where I could test it in many different, in sort of, you know, different induction, different amounts of light. Again, that was also tricky. Again, there's so many paradigms that we do in biology labs that are based around things that work well with like E. coli, mm-hmm. and things that grow well shaking in liquid.
Exactly.
And this is a bacteria that you can make it do that. You add a bunch of cellulase, it will, you know, degrade the cellulase it's producing, it will grow in a more turbid way. It's not very it's not very natural to how it actually grows, and so like for example, even when you add that, it still seems to make the media very like cloudy. It's maybe producing small amounts of cellulose or small short pieces of cellulose as you grow. Basically, the short run thing, I'm trying to say is basically you can't use OD measurements very accurately with this bacteria. Which means when you're trying to do a synthetic biology assay, a very simple one, so you add an inducer and you look at it over different concentration gradients of that inducer in a plate reader, you can't normalize by OD very well. So it makes it really difficult to do these sort of like Symbio 101 experiments. How, you know, if I add my inducer, what do I see? Even just like setting up simple protocols like that, it's kind of a pain. It's like everything is slower, everything is more, you know, annoying. And in the end, I had a plate reader experiment in the end where I tested like a range of different optogenetic constructs from Mustafa Kamaj, testing with different amounts of inducer. There's an inducer that used to produce the actual the polymerase, the light sensitive polymerase that was arabinose, and then obviously you induce with light and that causes it to dimerize and that produces the sort of the hollow enzyme that can then go on to express whatever downstream of your T7 polymerase, T7 promoter. And so testing different amounts of that first inducer, the arabinase, I could do it, but again, it's always never as pretty and as perfect as what you see in E. coli. And I was very aware of this because I was working in the lab with people who were working on yeast, Cerevisiae and E. coli, and it had such clean and perfect results. And then for me, it's always like, yes, I got a 1.7 fold change. Yeah, it's not 10,000 fold. It's not. So yeah, it was. So really, a lot of the time was just like figuring like, is the 10,000 fold like around the corner?
Uh-huh.
Like, is it, you know, if I work at this like for another month, will I get that? You know,
exactly.
Oh, I've got 100 fold now. Like, or is it always going to be in this 1.7 fold, 2 fold, and I just need to work with it?
Yeah.
And I ended up working with it in the end, and that's kind of the end result. And I think if I had another 10 years, I'd basically have to, you know, rethink so many of the processes and procedures that we do in Simbio to work around this particular organism, basically.
Okay, yeah. So it's very interesting, actually, to point out that, you know, it's a great story, but we don't know the struggles, the real struggles behind. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they are the smallest thing, as just measuring OD.
Yeah.
And this, and we are all used to very nice growing, mm-hmm. very fast growing organism, as you mentioned, E. coli. And it's just so we really don't give credit enough to these easy mm-hmm. model organisms that we can just use OD as a reference. And sometimes we are all stuck in the smallest and simplest of the procedures. And as you said, if you had more 10 years, maybe it would be the point to optimize, actually, will be how in Simbio you do the easiest of the experiments and not so much these big, elaborated constructs, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think ideally maybe it would be, instead of using plate readers, I'd be using microscopes to do all of my quantitative measurements,
or
something like that. Like, it may need to, like, that sort of difference in approach to really be accurate with essentially,
because it's really time consuming, and as you said, it's a pain, it's frustrating,
it's frustrating, the doubling time is like 3 to 4 hours, so just
crazy.
To put that into context for you,
and I think a lot of people listening to this will completely be like, yes, I also cry when I don't have a nice growth curve. Yeah, I'm not alone. Marcus, tell me something about So thank you very much for your now insights, deep insights into the protocol, let's say. Now let's go one step back and tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this work, because I know there were some non-scientists involved, right?
Yeah, definitely. So, like, there's kind of two sides to the inspiration, but I'll start with, like, the one that's, like, clearest in the paper, and that was during my PhD, I was quite fortunate. My supervisor was contacted by someone called Carol Collette, who is at Central St. Martin's, an art school in London, art and design school. And she was working on something, a biodesign sort of section to one of their courses there called Material Futures. And Material Futures is a pretty weird course. I won't necessarily be able to describe it perfectly, but it's bringing in people with very diverse sort of skill sets to try and imagine different futures, and a lot of it is based on materials, hence the name.
Okay, Material Futures is called.
Material Futures is the name of the course, though. And they were trying to sort of put, they were going to submit them to the Biodesign Challenge, which is this thing that happens in New York. And the idea was that they were going to have, like, their students sort of pair up into teams, and they would come up with projects, and the best project would go on to be submitted as CSM's entry into the Biodesign Challenge. And as a part of that, they needed or wanted a scientist to come in and, like, help guide, you know, the actual students a little bit, you know, at the confines, make sure it's not too science fiction, basically. And actually, Tom was initially brought into it. Tom was the one who did it. But then he invited me along, as well as Glenn, who was another person in the lab who started the PhD at the same time as me. And at first, I went in and I demonstrated nanopore sequencing of Comacartia bacteriaticus. So just demonstrating nanopore sequencing, basically. And that turned out to be useful because I needed to sequence the genome of this bacteria anyway. But then there were a few other sessions where we actually sort of went around and met the students and spoke to each individual group, and they told us about our idea. And it's through this that I met Jen Keane. And she is the, she's on the paper, she's definitely on the paper, and she's the person that I sort of made this shoot with, and she went on to found a company called Modern Synthesis. During these sessions, I actually met Jen Keane, and she was working, Jen Keane and Charlotte Kitchen were working on a project where they were trying to see what interesting things could they do with bacteriocytosis, essentially very broadly. And obviously they were working on it, I was working on it in my PhD, so naturally we ended up talking to each other quite a lot. And Jen Keane actually went on to take this project further and sort of work on it for her whole degree at CSM. And her background, she worked at Adidas for many years, and her background is in trainers and sneaker making. And she was very interested actually at the time in this idea of, like, introducing fibers into the bacteriocytosis as it grew, and how is the best way to create a device that could actually grow this material. So she's very into like, how do I make this into an actual material that people could use in fashion? Again, a lot of people have tried Fatima Sow's fashion. It's always, it creates a real material. You can make clothing out of it. The industrialization of the process is kind of there, but again, people aren't fully making clothing out of it yet. So she was in this space. I was like, okay, well, what can I as a synthetic biologist do to like make this more interesting for her? Like, what can I do? And there were actually a few other ideas around. I think one of the things that we're initially quite interested in is that the way the fibers are made is kind of somewhat random.
Okay.
The bacteria just sort of produce it, yeah. And they're like this. Whether there's a way to make them sort of all parallel along each other, okay. Or whether there's a way to actually almost have like a warp and weft.
So not so much through... intertangled kind of, but let's say more oriented, yeah. Vertically, let's say horizontally. Okay.
Exactly. So that was one other thing we were thinking about. Again, the answer that it may not be a synthetic biology, but more of a process or a growth process that might change that. But pigments started to settle on as a very obvious way to go. One, because it's something that biology does really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
It's always interesting to think like biology does things, some things well, and some things people do well, like humans do well.
Yes.
And pigmentation is something that biology does very well. It knows what to do. So that's one part of it. And this is where the other thing sort of comes in. So before melanin, I was actually interested in doing optogenetics and K. radica since the beginning of my PhD.
Okay.
And I'm very into photography. I wanted to do photography on a piece of bacterial cellulose. And I was doing a lot of black and white photography, so I was like, I really want something black. I want like a black thing. Again, like the basis is, it's so trivial often for these sorts of things, I think. But yeah, I just wanted something black. And I was thinking like, what's the best way to get something black? How do I do something black? Can I get like silver to stick to the bacteria? Like, what can I... And then, yeah, I just like, of course, melanin. And I just searched it. Came up, found like an iGEM team had already done it. Turns out it was an iGEM team.
Ah.
My supervisor, Tom Ellis, had already worked with like 10 years ago at Cambridge.
Crazy.
So I was like, Tom, have you ever done, you know, melanin in this bacteria? I was like, oh, no, I never thought of it. Like, that's a good idea. We should try.
Crazy.
And then I was like, yeah, Jen, I'm going to try and do melanin. We'll try and have a black material. And then that kind of, Jen went off, she finished her master's, and I just sort of set to work, and then we weren't working together for a while until I figured out how to get it to work well, basically, until I was able to get big black pellicles. And again, I'll just briefly say, the pellicle is the term we give to the layer of bacterial cellulose that grows at the top of the culture.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Just because I use that term quite a lot. So once I was able to make black sheets of bacterial cellulose, I was like, Jen, we've got to work together on something now. Jen had already made a version of her shoe sort of prototype concept. This is just with a wild type bacterial cellulose strain. And yeah, she came in and we made a black version of it together, essentially. And so she came into the lab. Because obviously it's genetic engineered, we have to do it in the lab. She was doing her stuff in like a studio or her bedroom. So she came into the lab and yeah, we made the shoe. I think it must have been quite interesting to see because, again, like this is large scale. So,
yes.
Like, it's, you know, we had a container that was probably maybe nearly a meter wide, sort of half a meter deep. It didn't really fit in any of our incubators that we had in the whole synthetic biology center. So, it has to be in a setup where we have like a heater to try and keep the temperature at 30 degrees on a rack covered in like a bag so it doesn't dry out. Like, these setups are a little bit, yeah, which is, which I think is always interesting, the concept of like a journal like this, where it's like,
yeah.
You need to have this balance of like the hard, and then like, the hard science, and then like, oh, and here's like, all right, and it's like this shoe, we did it once, and you can see it, and it's real. We did the shoe, and then we stained it, it stains itself black. We have like a video of it, like, slowly turning black.
I can
send it over just so you can see that little, it's like a, yeah, it's like a little time lapse of it. Basically you pull out the media, you change to a buffer, and the pH, the increase in the pH causes it to turn black.
Yeah,
that's another challenge actually,
the pH, right?
The
pH. I know you guys had problems with acidification, huh?
Yeah, it's, again, in the paper, I think, I wouldn't say, I don't, I move over it quite quickly. It's just like, we make it, here's the buffer, it turns back. Figuring out that we needed that buffer was not trivial, because when you put this gene into E. coli, it makes black.
Yeah.
It just, like, the colonies are black. Like, the cultures are black. When you, so, like, I put it into Caryatides, and the colonies do nothing, they look the same as normal. So, at first, you're like, I don't think this is working.
Exactly.
Exactly. And I knew that the pH was very important to, like, the actual enzymatic process. Like, that's been shown in vitro studies that it requires, like, a pH sort of at least 6 and above, and it's better in slightly alkaline pHs. So I knew it was a difficulty, but again, I'm working with an acetobacter. It produces vinegar. That's, like, literally what it's used for. Mm. And the pH drops to, like, 3-ish of the media. And, yeah, the acidification, I was trying a few different approaches. Like, again, like, sometimes I think the way to approach it is, like, is this a biological thing? Can I fix this through the engineering of the biology? Or is it a process thing? So my other thought was, like, if I could have, like, a culture device, almost like a bioreactor, to grow this in, where I could automatically track this pH and try and keep pushing it, nudging it up to stop it dropping. And I was trying to do this by hand, and any time you would, like, physically, like, interrupt the growth of the pellicle, it tends to sink because it's just floating on the top. Mm. And also, I'm also, like, doing something that's very unnatural to the organism. Like, if it's acidifying its media, this may be actually a part of its, like, actual natural way of living, almost. Like, I don't know if I'm necessarily making a nice growing environment for this organism if I'm constantly trying to add an AOH to keep rising the pH. And so in the end, I was just like, okay, I'll just grow it, and I just put it into buffer, and yeah, it went black. And I was like, okay, that works.
That works, done.
That works. Like, I was like, this is the thing, I remember I was trying to, like, I think use, like, PBS to try and increase the buffer. And I was like, okay, what if I just put it in the PBS? And yeah.
Sometimes that's exactly how science is, right? It's like, it works. And now let's move on from this unexpected event and try to understand how it works. But exactly. We hold then to that, right? We don't want
to... Exactly. Yeah. It works, and then you do, like, a whole bunch of experiments to prove that it's working. And you have everything is, like, perfect and clean and repeated and nice. But first, just, like, it works.
Because sometimes, really, people go like, but how exactly was the process, the rational? It was no rational, it was more, but you don't really say this on the paper, right? So you don't say, this is exactly how we went in this 1, 2, 3 step. No, it was step 10, and then step 8, and then we went to 1. And so this is...
Exactly, yeah.
And also very cool now you tell us about the inspiration or how it came, and it was a mix of, art... so material future course with some people doing biodesign challenges, a bit of scientists, but not so much scientific-y, and also photography. So it's actually like one could never foresee this, right? Because this is, I think, something that be like, when I want, I don't know, some people say, okay, I want to have a very, very nice publication of my PhD and brilliant and, I don't know, in Nature Biotechnology, but you don't really... When you are living and doing the science, you're not really conscious about this. You're just moving from, and I think that's the beauty, right? That you just kind of move from step to step and let science happens, basically.
And a somewhat unpredictable process. I wouldn't know had I started if I started this PhD again, right? I wouldn't know
exactly
how to do it again.
So many times we think, okay, next time in the next life. Because, of course, in the next life, we will all do another PhD. I will do it way better than this time. We're more efficient, at least.
Exactly, but no, that's not the case.
Yeah. Marcus, I have here a question about... so you mentioned your shoe and the staining of the shoe that you have this time lapse, and your wallet and so on. And so... And you also mentioned, of course, that how it started with the people from this art school. What about... in the outlook, so a bit put it in context, of course, not only this the story that is given in this paper, but engineering living materials in the scope of fashion design. You presented this very nice black collar we already spoke about, which is super trendy and necessary. You have patterns, this is very nice, but you have also this component of so ethical issues that here are also a topic because you are providing a vegan option to also an industry that is produce a lot of pollution, a lot of waste. And so having these considerations, so economy, ethical issues, and kind of bright opening now a bit the scope, how you see so much or how you feel about these topics on today's life, also considering that you moved on with your career, right? So now you are working for a company that kind of stands upon these values, right?
Yeah. So the there's multiple parts. I would say, like, going small, briefly, for the case of bacteriocellulose, I think we're still at a point where an organization yet, beyond Nata de Coco, what you put in bubble tea, I don't think any organization yet has made a strong market for bacteriocellulose-based materials. And there are a couple of companies working on, obviously, Modern Synthesis, the one that Jen started, Body Bion, another company in Mexico who are trying to work on it. And the way I always saw the bacteriocellulose engineering project that I did was kind of like it would sit atop this world if it and when it becomes a natural marketable product. So it was always like, oh, maybe this is the innovation that makes it a more marketable product.
Yes.
Like maybe actually the cellulose itself is not interesting. You add melanin or maybe you add something else through synthetic biology and now you have something that is very leather-like. So in that sense, like, the economics, again, we'll see if they get there. I hope they do, obviously. But yeah, we're still waiting for like an actual bacterial cellulose market product to be.
Do you know if there's any startup already doing this?
So like again, so like the in terms of the so there's like companies who make it purely for food, but there's companies who are doing it for fashion. So it's the Modern Synthesis is what Jen started.
Okay.
They're still trying to find, you know, the people to make stuff out of their materials. There's Poly Bion, who are also making materials. That's another bacteriocellulose company. Goes and Bioworks is another one. And I think these companies, you know, some of them have different structures. Some of them are trying to, say, sell to people who are making sell to a company that makes things. They sell it to, like, Hermes or something like that, or some of these are, you know, more interested in actually making products out of the materials that they produce in-house, and so they have a full chain. The broader thing in general, I think so a lot of these bacterial cellulose companies are aiming this vegan at the vegan market, the alternative leather market. Again, my understanding here is one part of that comes from a sort of seeking investment standpoint. I think there was a lot of interest in, again, there was the whole fake meat things like Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people saw the money involved in that. We're like, okay, what else can we replace? And I think, well, if we're already replacing the cow, let's replace the leather as well. And I think there was money in that, you know, alternative leather market as well. So, a lot of the, you know, it's anytime you're producing something through like these complex biotechnology routes, it's very, very expensive to do these first runs. And so if you can target a market that charges a lot of money already, like leather, then great. Because, sure, if you can, you know, if it's already okay, if the bag costs £10,000, great. Like,
yeah.
Like, that's something we can be. If we're trying to replace polyurethane-based, petroleum-based leather, that's going to be tricky, but maybe if we can just replace, you know, the vegan leather, a leather used, say, in an Hermes bag, that's more achievable. So I think that's one reason why they always go, or so many companies go towards this, like, let's make vegan leather approaches. And that's I would still say the best framing for the work as it was, like melanin-based materials. You could almost say, like you know, if you have, like, a black cow, you already have a melanin-based material at that point. So, like, it is sort of going towards maybe a more natural convergence. It's sort of naturally converging towards that point. But I think for me, what I find more interesting is to move beyond that a little bit.
Okay.
Move beyond, like, the vegan leather thing. Because fundamentally, these materials are not leather. They aren't a collagen-based material from an animal. Like I always find it more interesting to think, what could this material be? Like, how could you, I mean, like, leather is already like a set. Like, we know what leather feels like.
I get you.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, so not
kind of know what leather
not
is.
Focusing on kind of replacing, but really exploring
yeah.
the new material
exactly.
that we
yeah,
still
like,
don't have, as you said, in the in our texture, memory texture, or in our smell. Okay, that's
exactly,
interesting.
Yeah,
interesting
like,
view. Yeah.
Well, that's what I find more interesting. I think, like, and again, like, we have like. Plastics are a really good example of something where plastics can replicate what we have. We can have a polyurethane-based
yeah.
plate leather, or you can have something like latex. You can have like sports clothing, like a stretchy t-shirt, but that's not feasible right plastics. Like, that is a new product that is emergent of a completely new chemistry. Like, I'm interested in like what like new product would be emergent of something like a new biological production platform.
Okay, that's very cool.
And that's kind of where I think, again, like, to make that market, you know, have that in a market, it's tricky. I'm still figuring out how it works.
Yeah. No, I mean, but I think you are in a very good path, right? So you are now,
yeah.
You concluded your PhD very successfully. You published quite a lot. And now, in a way, of course, I already know the answer for this question, but in a way, of course, your entire PhD experience not determined, but directed a little bit where you want to go with your career now, right? So
yeah.
How do you feel now after this transition? Because this is also something that might be of interest for the mm-hmm. early career ones. You transition now from PhD mm-hmm. with now with that you share with all the struggles that the PhD brings along
yeah.
In a very, very nice topic. So of involving a lot of that we just spoke, economical, some ethical issues, and some
mm-hmm.
Things that we still don't know, cannot so much foresee, but we are eager to explore. And now you are working for a company, but that somehow is exploring also in this direction, right? In a combination of nature
yeah.
or observing a bit nature and,
mm-hmm.
and bringing it to making us better, let's say, right? Our world
yeah.
and us better, right? How is this transition
exactly.
going?
It's interesting. It's a lot of transitions for me. I also moved from London to New York, so there's you know quite a lot of things. And I will also say, like, the transition from me finishing, so I ended up doing a short postdoc after my PhD and then moving to this company was not super smooth. It was quite a few months where I was unemployed, basically.
Yeah.
I wrote a lot of this paper after my postdoc ended, so... Yeah, I wanted this paper to be sort of done and out of the way before I started the next position. Again, that is the eternal challenge, I guess, for like academics. It's like, how do you like, you know, if you start another postdoc and you're still writing papers
exactly.
from the last one, how do you?
Yeah.
I think doing that when you're going from one postdoc to an industry position is even harder, I feel like. Like, because I think there's maybe less allowance for like that sort of, oh yeah, you're just working on your previous, no, you're like, yeah, this is your job now, like you don't. So I really wanted this paper to be out of the way before I started this next position. And yeah, it's interesting. I'm working on a lot of things that I've mm-hmm. never worked on before. I'll be honest, I probably shouldn't say too much because Oxman is supposed to be in stealth mode.
Oh, okay. I think you already said what is nice. This
yeah.
kind of getting like closure in a place, but
exactly,
excited
yeah.
to start something new.
Yeah, but I would say like we have got a sort of event planned in June when we plan to show off what we're doing.
Awesome.
So, and hopefully by the time June comes around, we can talk a lot
okay,
more
awesome.
About what's actually happening.
Then we'll keep an eye on
yeah.
for that. I think we are wrapping up close to the
cool.
end now. I think it was a very, very lively and enlightening and enthusiastic description of not only your paper but also the struggles, and I think that's where
yeah.
a lot of people don't talk about, and I really hope that this podcast series go explore a bit more of really this
mm-hmm.
honesty behind the science that we do regarding problems, regarding concepts, basically the entire construction of a story
mm-hmm.
Is interesting from the inspiration time to, of course, the writing time. Like you said, it happened.
Yeah.
It didn't happen in the lab anymore, so it happened already in outside. So there is not really a defined red line, and there's not temporal scales are a bit flexible. So very nice to get this real honest view or testimony of exactly how it was to do these amazing constructs, and I can only imagine now how that room with this container looked like. One last, maybe just if you have any advice for anyone that is somehow, as we just also mentioned before, it's very hard and I think it's almost impossible to tell that or to say, from the moment I started this project, I knew it was going to be big. You don't know really, right? You just move on step by step. So this will be maybe something that I will also say, okay, just regardless of the dimension of that work, just do it, right? Just follow something.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for someone that is now at the bench and will like one day to be here at the podcast?
I'm never much of an advice giver. I think from my own, like, thinking through sort of my own thought process throughout the PhD, it's trying to understand personally what is it that your skills can actually bring to a project. I think there's, like, certain people are really you know, they can really, like, hammer out, do 100 clones. They'll do 10,000 mini preps this week. They'll do 100, like, they can really do that and understand, like, what project is emergent of, like, that skill set. And I know that is not my skill set. I am not the person to clone 100 constructs in a week. Like, so, like, understand, like, okay, I'm interested in this. Like, if I can't be, like, super efficient, can I be really weird? Can I be, can I be, like, eclectic? Can I bring in things to different areas? So, like, just understanding, like, I guess, like, how your brain works, how you like to work, and then understanding what actual project is emergent of that, if that makes any sense. That's the only thing.
Basically, it makes a lot of sense. Basically, it's just, like, seeing who you are, your personality, and your patience level is, and then somehow adapt that to which questions can I answer. Because, as you said, maybe you're not the best one to clone the 1,000 mutants, but you have other skill sets that can apply then to other questions or to answer other questions.
Exactly.
No, that's also very good advice. I think we wrap up now. I just have to thank you again, Marcus. It was lovely talking to you. And we close the first episode of From Bench to Podcast. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.